composer John Corigliano is in town. His string quartet, the only string quartet he's written thus far, was performed tonight at the Corbett Auditorium on the campus of the University of Cincinnati, sponsored by the Cincinnati Chamber Music Society. They also did some songs based on texts and poems by Bob Dylan. This is the scherzo from a string quartet, simply called String Quartet Scherzo, by John Corigliano. As I had mentioned a moment ago, John Corigliano is in town for a rare visit as the Cincinnati Chamber Music Society put on a concert of his own quartet. And is that a quartet that you put together yourself?
This is a quartet that actually got put together. It was put together at the Bloomington University in Indiana to play the quartet, and I took them out to dinner afterwards and said, "You people play so well together," because they'd just gotten together to do that. I said, "You should really think of becoming a quartet." And a month later, they called me up and said, "Well, we made a decision to become a string quartet, and we'd like to name it the Corigliano Quartet," which was a terrific honor for me.
I bet. I bet that really stoked you up, didn't it?
Oh, boy. It's amazing. And they're just fabulous. They're wonderful kids. The audience loved them. They were just swept off by them.
You say kids. How old are these guys?
Well, 20s.
Okay.
You know.
They're kids.
Yep. In my league, they are.
All right. Tell us a little bit about the quartet, the members of the quartet, and then tell us a little bit about the piece as it was performed in Cincinnati tonight.
Well, the piece was part of two pieces. I mean, there were two 40-minute pieces. It was a program, a rather large program. The string quartet players, Michael Lim is the first violinist of the players. Jeff Ziegler is the cellist. We have... actually, what's interesting in this quartet is the first and second violinists very often change from quartet to quartet. That is, there is no real first because of a democracy of violins being equal. So all the players play great passion, and they're really fabulous. And there was a wonderful young singer and pianist who I met for the first time today at 1 o'clock. Who had learned Miss Tambourine Man, this 40-minute song cycle on Bob Dylan. And that is an extremely difficult work, and we had less than 40 minutes to rehearse it, and the piece takes 40. So I was quite stunned by the terrific performance they put out tonight.
Well, now, that second piece of yours, the Mr. Tambourine Man song cycle,
yes.
That's an interesting piece and probably deserves a little comment as well, because you're a classical music composer, and from what I read in the paper and in your bio, you didn't have that much knowledge of Mr. Dylan's work, but you took some of his words from some of his old songs and scored them for a contemporary type soprano and an ensemble.
Well, actually, it's not an ensemble. It's art songs, just soprano and piano.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I didn't know any of his music or words, but I had been told that his words were especially beautiful and poetic. And so I looked up Amazon and I bought a book of... The Complete Bob Dylan Lyrics, which is a rather thick book with hundreds of pages, and went through them all and picked seven of them that I thought I could really work with and built the song cycle on those seven. And some of them are extremely famous. For example, Blowin' in the Wind or Mr. Tambourine Man are very famous, and Forever Young and All Along the Watchtower are also pretty well known. And some of them, like Clothesline, or Masters of War, are less well known. But they came together, and I, having not heard his music, said it the way I thought it should go. And of course, the big difference between folk music and, say, the art song, the classical art song, is that in folk music, the same melody is repeated verse for verse with different words, and in the art song, the melody is always played reflecting the words, which means that although it may repeat, it would change considerably depending upon the words of the second verse or the third verse or whatever. So in my songs, they are much more sensitive to the immediacy of the text, just by the nature of art being art songs.
And I'll bet you they sound a lot different than Bob Dylan's records.
Oh, boy, do they.
Now, has Mr. Dylan gotten wind of this?
Oh, sure. He had to get wind of it. You can't do this in secret because there are such things as lawyers.
So this is all done on the up and up then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, of course.
Has he heard them?
I don't know if he's heard them. He's on tour right now.
He's always on tour.
Well, I don't know if he's heard them, and I'm trying to get one of the singers who does a really good job of it, who lives in Los Angeles, to just go to his house someday with a pianist and sit him down in a chair and do the whole cycle for him. And I'm trying to arrange that because I think it'd be a real hoot for him.
You know, Bob's famous for saying things like music shouldn't be complicated.
Yep, I know that. And you know the other thing? He hasn't heard this, and he probably will hate it. But I would love to have him hear it anyway.
Right.
And it doesn't stop me from loving his words and a lot of his music too, which I think is very beautiful. It's just a different world of music than mine.
Now, for those who aren't familiar with your work, the music of John Corigliano goes way back. You've got two symphonies, some movie soundtracks, and an opera, I believe, too, right?
Right, right.
And I think you're working on a musical, something that's supposed to be really wacky.
Well, I'd like to be working on that musical, but my librettist, my co-writer, is busy working on another musical with somebody, and since that's scheduled for a reading, I can't get through to him right now. So I'm going to have to wait a little bit on that. Because he's working on one job and he can't get to the other one. Mm-hmm. But I'll get there. I'll get there.
Is this going to be some kind of wacky West Side Story?
It's a rather strange piece. Yeah, about New York. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But it's so far from fruition. You know, musicals are completely different in the way they're the way you write them than a concert piece. Because in a concert piece, even an opera, you get commissioned by a performing organization that wants to do it, and they give you a deadline and a date and a fee, and you just have to get music in at certain points. But if you want to write a musical, you're on your own. Nobody commissions it. Absolutely no one. You have to sort of do some of it and then have people listen to it to see if, in fact, they want to go further with it.
Well, if you're an established composer and writer, don't you have some sort of gig, some sort of performance, some light at the end of the tunnel so you know when it's done, you at least have a performance at, Lincoln Center or something?
Well, not really. Look at Stephen Sondheim. I mean, the last two musicals that he started were abandoned. They just never saw the light of day. And he's Stephen Sondheim. So I don't really think... It's a different world. It really is. The director walked out of one of his musicals and... The director's power was so much that the backers pulled out, and there's no more performance of it. Look at Bernstein with 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, who wrote that musical, and you would think Leonard Bernstein, being Leonard Bernstein, would have something to say. He was actually locked out of the process of some of the production of it and not permitted to give his input.
Hmm.
You see, so it's a different world. I mean, if you have your symphony played, then that conductor and that orchestra is there to satisfy your imagination. And if you want a little faster or slower, you tell them so. But if you're writing a musical, the director tells you that this has to be cut, this has to be changed, and we're going to turn this backwards. And you have to do it. It's very much like being a film composer, in which you are fulfilling the vision of the director, and it's not really your vision.
That's right, and from what I've heard, you can write a compelling score for a movie, then the director is going to cut it up into little sound bites that work with certain scenes.
It's even worse than that. The famous ones are Kubrick, I think it was. Is he the one who did 2001?
Yes.
Well, evidently, he had two film scores. He paid for the composer, which has got to be hundreds of thousands of dollars, the copyist, the full orchestra recording, that we're talking now about an awful lot of money, then threw one of them out, then did a second one, and then he went back to the original recordings he put in back of it as what we call a temp track,
uh-huh.
And he used those. People can take out the main climax of your score. I know in Aliens, Jerry Goldsmith's main last scene was removed by the director, and the director put the finale of Howard Hanson's Second Symphony in. And there's nothing Jerry could do about it. So you really, it's not the same world. Theater, film is box office oriented, but the concert hall is thought of as a place where the creator has, more input.
Well, let me ask you something about the difference between composing, art music or whatever you want to call it, and film scores. because more than 75, maybe 100 years ago, there were no such things as film scores. And composers made their money and made their living by writing operas or symphonies or whatnot. But all of a sudden, this new medium has come along. And I know that you've not only written symphonies, string quartets, and art songs, but you've also written film scores, most recently The Red Violin. And Altered States, I think you did 15 or 20 years
ago. I did. Altered States, Revolution, and The Red Violin.
Yeah, so what's the difference in your mind when you sit down with the blank score in front of you? You got all the staff paper, there's not a thing on it, you got a pen in your hand, and you're going to sit down and write a score for a movie instead of a symphonic work. What's the different creative process that goes through your mind?
Well, you don't sit down with a blank page, in a sense, because even though the page may be blank, you have a visual image that you're watching, with words and a mood and timings. In other words, you have to fill 1 minute and 47 seconds of sound and music. You have to have the music be very tense and nervous-making, and at a certain point you have to dip the music because there's a word being said, and then the music has to reach a peak and cut out, and that is agreed upon with you and the director. So it's much easier for you to begin writing because you already know sort of what you have to do.
So do you sit down with a VCR or maybe a film or something in front of you when you sit down to write the music for a film score?
Every composer does with a film, yes. There used to be things called moviolas in the old days, which were more or less the same as our television things now, but they ran the film through, and the composer would sit with a moviola and play it and play it and compose against it. But now with the television sets and VCRs, all you do is pop your VCR in, put your television set on your piano, get your music paper out, and get the timings and start writing.
Well, is it really any different than composing 100 or 150 years ago for a ballet?
Maybe not. I'll tell you how ballet works. Either they adopt a piece of yours to make it a ballet, in which case...
They dance to your music instead of you write music to some choreography.
Right, which means that you don't do anything. But very often when you choreograph, when you write music for choreography, the choreographer actually can give you the beats like they did with Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky's ballets were actually choreographed, and then he was given, there'll be 11 beats of this, and then we want 12 of these, 2 of those, 4 of these. And it's like a film score. He was given his parameters, and he had to fill that in with music.
So I guess in a traditional sense, the antiquity of ballet is probably the closest thing to the modern contemporary film score.
I would say there's a relationship, yes.
Most people would probably say opera, but with opera, you come in with nothing but a script
of
the libretto, and then you write the music, and it's still pretty much your ball game, isn't it?
It is. Well, of course, there is the diva, don't forget. it's never your ball game when there's a soprano who's got a high C in it and could bring down the house.
So you got to hit all those notes.
It's not just that, but that gives a certain power quotient. And the director of opera has come to be the same as a director in film. That is, they're originally in opera, there were no directors, basically. Direction is a rather recent innovation. And today, it's really an art form of the director because they play the same old operas over and over again. And the way to make them fresh is to have a director, take Carmen and set it in Havana in 1911 or something and redo it that way or redo it another way so they can play the same operas over and over again. So it's become a director's art form. And so if you write a new opera, you run the worry of picking a director that has enough, restraint to let it be your opera. Because, and not a version of your opera, because the very first time your opera is done, you don't want a version of it. I mean, it's one thing to set Carmen in a weird place or set Mozart in Trump Towers, but then again, we know how Mozart really sounds in his original way and where he was originally set. But if you write a new opera and the director resituates it and does things to change it, in a sense, nobody ever got to hear the real original. So for a composer with a premiere, you really have to find the director that's willing to realize your vision. And many of the biggest directors are not interested in that.
I'm talking to composer John Corigliano on WAIF, the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show. And, if we had more time, I could probably come up with 1,000 more questions, because it's not every day that you get to interview a contemporary Beethoven. If Beethoven was around, we could talk about, all this and much more. But before I let you go, I just have two more questions.
Sure.
First of all, the string quartet that was performed tonight, it's just your, it's not number one, it's just the string quartet, right?
Yes.
What's interesting to me about it is that there was some inspiration from Muslim and Islamic prayer meditation.
Right.
And with everything that's going on right now politically, there's a lot of, I would just call it racism, stereotypical racism going on with members of the Arab and the Muslim community, which is probably not founded in anything legitimate. You've got a few terrorists over there that just happen to be Arab or Muslim, but the rest of the Muslim religion is a beautiful thing. Could you tell us a little bit about the music you incorporated into the string quartet and how it all works?
Well, in the middle movement of the string quartet, it's a night music, just like Eine kleine Nacht music of Mozart. But this night music is set in a particular place because when I was in Morocco, and I've been there several times, and I'd go to the holy city of Fez, and if you get a room facing the square, the Medina, where all the mosques are, what happens is that, you see, because the Arabic service is five times a day, and four of those times they call you to service by singing over microphones, and the faithful go in, and in the mosque they perform the service. But the fifth one is at 4 in the morning, or 3 in the morning, and it's very difficult to have people all leave their houses then. So what they actually do is they sing the whole service out with the speakers, and everybody hears it. And that will be one thing, but the other thing about it that's especially interesting is that if you do this in a town like Fez, where there are 80 to 100 different mosques, you're going to have the calls of one mosque, and then on the left side, the call of another, and they echoing throughout the valley, and a third, and a fourth, and a tenth, and a 15th, and a 20th, and they're all these voices singing, and they're all singing differently, but they're all very, very ornate, as Arabic music can be. And I thought that was a gorgeous moment. I remember I was out on the terrace listening to this beautiful, beautiful whirling of sounds, of passionate religious sounds. And that gave me the idea for a night music that would, at its peak, have these calls, and then these calls would slowly die away, and it took about 25 minutes for them to do so, almost a half an hour. And then at the very end, the cock crowed, and you could see the first glint of light, you know, on the eastern horizon, and the dawn was going to be coming. So that was the night music I picked. And as far as, you know, the Arab world goes, certainly Morocco is a wonderful place, and the king of Morocco has been extremely supportive about the views of anti-terrorism. He says terrorists are not Muslims. They're not followers of Islam at all. You have many people in those countries who feel that way, and the worst thing in the world we could do is to generate hatred based upon somebody's belief in a God and in something beautiful. We have to understand that, and that there's always going to be fundamentalists. There are fundamentalists we know in our country that have been in religious fundamentalists that have asked for terrible laws to be passed. Obviously, they're not as violent as the Muslim extremists.
Hold on, some of them are.
Well, some of them are. Some of them are. But, I mean, the point is they're always going to find that kind of extremism, but we certainly don't look at the religion and say that's what the religion is. We look at the extremists and say that those are people who are distorting the religion for their own reasons. And I think we all have to do that here.
Well, amen to that. I come onto the radio every week down here, and I like to try to counter some of the things I hear, even on the religious radio stations that we have here in town, where they come on and they just start telling you right away what a bunch of devils and Satan worshippers Muslims are, and it's not true.
Well, that's unfortunate, because they're behaving like fundamentalists then.
Yes, they are.
All fundamentalism is bad. Fundamentalism means there's only one way. And the problem is, when you say there's only one way, just like Bin Laden does, there's only one way, it excuses you're doing anything. But the fact is there are many ways. And we know this in this country. This is a country that accepts many ways. We have many different viewpoints, our religions, many different religions. so we cannot exclude a religion or anything else because we personally don't happen to like it. We have to know that it has its rights to exist just as all of them do. And as long as everything is meant with love and without hurting another person, it is not only to be tolerated but celebrated. Our country is our greatest asset, is our diversity. So we should celebrate that. And the Muslims in this country should be honored for that too, because they're diverse members of our country.
You know, the same is true for the compositional technique. You can't be fundamental about that, especially in this contemporary, you know, music scene. So many different styles and techniques can be used when you're composing any kind of music, whether it's rock and roll, jazz, or chamber music.
Right.
What you were saying about hearing the singers in the mosques almost reminded me a little bit about Charles Ives, where he'd hear the different marching bands coming down the different ways.
Right.
He'd mix them into his symphony, and all of a sudden, the symphony sounds like John Philip Sousa, but then wait a minute.
Yeah.
There's another marching band on the other side of the symphony, and they also sound like John Philip Sousa, but it's all mixing up.
Right.
And it gets to be a bit cacophonous, which is not what the nocturne in your string quartet is about, but it sounds like the compositional technique might have been similar approach.
It is a similar technique. It's the idea of several things happening. Each one of them is very simple, but they're all happening at the same time, and you're able to hear all of them. And it's a wonderful mix of sounds. And, you know, you don't use that for all of a piece, but for part of a piece, that can be quite exciting.
We're talking to composer John Carigliano on the Chris and Rob Show, WAIF Radio. And I just have one more question left, and then we'll let you go.
Okay.
Perhaps we can do this again sometime, because it's fascinating to talk to you.
Sure.
And I'd like to have you on again and play some of your records in more in depth and in more detail. About, I think it was either last season or the season before, the Cincinnati Symphony programmed Your Symphony Number 1 by John Carigliano. It had a subtitle about AIDS. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the symphony was written in 1990, and it was commissioned by the Chicago Symphony. I was their composer in residence, and George Schulte was the conductor, Sir George Schulte, at that time, 89 and 90. And he had asked me to write a concerto for orchestra. However, just as I was about to start doing that, one of my closest friends, a fantastic pianist and musician, came down with pneumocystis pneumonia, and we realized he had AIDS. And at that time, that meant he was going to die. And I had looked around me, and I saw so many musician friends and other friends that have gone, and I realized that a concerto for orchestra was meaningless. Because we're in the middle of, well, we had the second one now, the second invasion of our country. It was a silent invasion that crippled and killed people and provided millions with fear for their lives. And I felt I had to reflect that. And I picked a symphony because the symphony is our largest form in orchestra. And it was such a titanic subject, the idea of all of these people perishing in such terrible ways. And so I wrote this symphony in honor of this friend of mine who died a week after the premiere but did get to hear it, and my other friend who died. And each movement is about a friend in the music world, and the third movement is a kind of quilt, like the A's Memorial quilt, of memories of other friends in music, all in music. There are no words. It's a symphony, and in fact, it's not called an AIDS symphony. But if you read the program notes, it talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that we can realize that the wonderful thing about concert music is that it doesn't have words, that it is abstract, and that therefore people can feel what they need to feel. And it's unthreatening. For example, people who have trouble with AIDS, the various prejudices and problems, could listen to this piece and be moved, and then perhaps read the program notes and understand the human condition that caused it, and maybe we'll get through some barriers that way. I believe that the greatness of the symphonic world is in the very fact that it isn't specific. And although AIDS generated this, I hope there will be a day when people will ask, what is AIDS, when they hear this symphony? And we'll simply hear it as a tragic symphony.
Good. I'm going to play the tarantella from it in just a moment to take the program out. I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you're at a meet and greet tonight after the concert, and you probably got your hands full with all that, but you still took the time to give us a call.
Sure.
And we appreciate that. I wanted to thank you.
A pleasure.
Also to mention that there's a new CD out on Sony Classical called Phantasmagoria, and among some of the other artists, Emmanuel Axe and Yo-Yo Ma, who appear on the CD, James Toko plays piano on it, and he's from Cincinnati, isn't he?
Right. He's a fabulous pianist, and he gives an extraordinary performance of a very difficult piano piece of mine on that.
It's the Etude Fantasy.
Right.
So that's a CD worth checking out for those who are so inclined. And again, thanks for taking the time to give us a call.
A pleasure.
Are you enjoying your stay in Cincinnati?
Very much.
Have you been here before?
Oh, sure.
Have you had the chili?
Have I had the chili?
Yeah.
I don't have any chilies right now, but I'm feel... Yeah, I had chili, yes.
Well, ask your hosts about the chili if you're in the mood before you leave town.
Okay.
It'll really mess things up for you.
All right.
All right, thanks a lot.
Sure.
This is the Tarantella from John Corigliano's Symphony No. 1.